Well, can you believe that Thanksgiving is done? We're kind of in the middle of the fall. All the decorations are out. We're trying to see if the gourds and the pumpkins will stay fresh until, you know, Halloweenish time. We're just finishing off the last of our first part of the journey through the story. So there's several movements through the story, and the first is from Eden to Egypt. And this morning we want to take a look at Joseph, but in case you haven't been here and you need a little bit of recap, I'm going to move through things fairly quickly this morning so we can get to where we really need to be. So we've already looked at creation, sin entering the world, Adam and Eve, and people make a choice for death rather than life. They leave the garden, and God begins a plan, unfolding a grand narrative to pursue after his people. And he chooses a man named Abraham, and through a series of events, he promises to bless all people through Abraham. And Abraham proves himself faithful and obedient to God and begins to receive the blessing that God has offered. Blessing is not earned, it's offered and received. And Abraham, if you put up the next slide there, Joel, Abraham has a larger, very large family. You may not be able to read that from where you are, but Abraham has a son, Isaac, and Isaac meets Rebekah, and through Rebekah, he has Esau and Jacob and a bunch of daughters. And through Jacob, there are 12 sons and one daughter born. Now, there's a whole backstory to Jacob and Esau and their struggle. Jacob steals the older brother's blessing with the help of his mom, and there's some enmity, and they are separated for a time. But towards the close of that, when they're about to meet again, Jacob wrestles with God. Jacob wrestles with God, and God gives him a new name. Now, you'll notice something throughout Scripture. God often gives new names to people because he takes the identity that they had known about themselves and changes it to be the identity that he sees in them. Now, Jacob sounds like the word for heel or deceiver, which he was. He stole his older brother's blessing and all that went through that. And we can see this morning, blessing is very important to God. Jesus called the little children to him because people had brought them so he could lay hands on them and bless them. Blessing's important to God. Blessing was important to the Jewish people. So God changes Jacob's name to be Israel. That would be the name through whom his people would be known. All throughout the Old Testament, heading into the New, the Israelites. Now, today we call them the Jewish people, but they're really the Israelites. And so Jacob's name is changed. And a little bit before this time, he enters into one of the greatest love stories ever imagined, ever lived. It's real deal, right? We're not reading stories. I know it's called the story, but it's narrative. It's real life. And Jacob falls in love with a girl. And he says to himself, I'm working for this girl's father, and makes a deal. If I work for you 7 years, then can I marry her? And so he sees Rachel, and he works 7 years, has a wedding. I don't know how all this works, but he wakes up the next day, and he realizes he's been tricked. Whether it's the veil or whatever's going on, it's Leah, Rachel's older sister. And the father says, hold on, we have a custom here. I can't marry off my younger daughter. I'm going to marry off my older one. So Jacob says, fine. And he works another 7 years, 14 years. Who was engaged 14 years before they got married? Who's now husband worked 14 years for your father to get your hand in marriage? No, so all you are slackers, all of you, all right? So Jacob works very hard, and he marries Leah and Rachel. He marries another woman named Zilpah, and he sleeps with one of their housemaidens, one of their servants. Now, polygamy is not God's plan, all right? Terrible things happen with polygamy. God never says in his word, this is wonderful. It was cultural. In fact, when we get further on in the story, God says, look, all these detestable things that the nations around you are doing, stop doing them. They're hurting you. Because with Jacob, who was his favorite? Who did he work 14 years for? Rachel, right? who's his favorite wife? You ever watch Sister Wives? Yeah. Rachel is his favorite wife. Who do you think his favorite kids are? Okay, Joseph and Benjamin. Joseph and Benjamin are his favorite kids, and he doesn't hide it at all, not even a little bit. In fact, out of Joseph and Benjamin, he says, well, Joseph's the older one, so you're my ultimate favorite. He makes this robe. Now, robes are really important. It's not just clothes. It defines how others see you. So if you're wearing rags, that tells you something about that person. If you're wearing certain robes, it means you have a place of authority in a kingdom. And oftentimes, people who are blessed or are in power or who get a gift, they get given a robe. The prodigal son story, okay, a parable. Jesus says, the father, you know, put a robe, the royal robe, his robe, onto the son so that everyone know he's okay. He's back. He's restored. And so Jacob makes this beautiful technicolor dream coat and gives it to him. Now, here's the thing about Joseph. Joseph is a bit of a dreamer, and Joseph starts to have these dreams. Now, you can see he's got 11 brothers, one full-blood brother, and a sister. And he starts to tell them that, look, I'm having these dreams. And in these dreams, one of them, all of you, my brothers, you bow down to me. And another one, my whole family bows down to me. Now, Joseph is his dad's favorite. How much of a favorite do you think he is with his brothers saying stuff like that? Not very much, right? Now, I don't think Joseph was a brat. I don't think he was like, you know, God's blessing me. I think he's honestly and genuinely naive and pure. So long story short, Joseph was the favorite with his dad, not the favorite with his siblings. Now, when we think of a plan, an overall plan for someone's life, we can think of it in construction building terms, all right? This week, I met with a man from an architect company and came in and did some, he spent about 3 hours measuring up the stage and up around here. We're starting to look into the idea of freshening up the auditorium and downstairs and the parking lot and some of the appliances in the kitchen and things. And so we're trying to get an idea of what will this cost? What will it take to do this plan? In fact, this projector thing we're looking at today, we're demoing it to see if it'll work here. We're starting to count the cost, as it were. And so in this plan, in order for it to really see its way through, someone has to be able to see the whole thing. So someone has to be able to say, okay, we understand this whole plan, but someone else has to understand the intricate little pieces and whether it's going to work at all. Okay, will these pieces go together? Can we do this whole overall thing? A plan is very important, and God has a plan for each one of our lives. In fact, God has a plan for your life. And we need to understand the big picture. So Joel, if you skip a couple slides here. Okay, who can tell me who that is? And don't mind the little weird ghosty things. It's a stitched together picture, okay? So it's kind of like Google Maps. You ever seen on Google Maps, you can see a couple cars. Who is that? Do you know? Do you know? You should know. No, you shouldn't. We have no idea who that is. All right, so here's a girl. Okay, I want you to keep your eye on the girl. Okay, Joel, when I say next, you just keep going. Next. Okay, see her? Next. Okay, next. Okay, look. Do you see her? Do you see her? See her way up in there? Next. Next. Do you see her? Where she's kind of right there. All right? This is called a gigapixel picture. Okay, you got cameras. We see them today. You buy them and you're thinking, I'm just going to get a pocket camera because it's 4 megapixels, but I want the new Canon D or something. It's got 19,000 megapixels. This is a gigapixel. You have to measure the high resolution in gigapixels. That girl we saw, that's this picture zoomed way in. Everyone's like, the photographers are saying, where do I get that? Wouldn't that make family pictures easy? You set it across the road and put it on auto for like 5 minutes. You've got to capture something that's usable. Let's do something in reverse. Okay, next one, Joel. Okay, obviously this is Washington, D.C., but what I want you to do is just shout out when you think you know what this event is. Next. Okay, next. inauguration for who next? Okay. Obama. Keep going in. One more. Okay, so here's Obama. All right. If you're looking at the big picture, you have no idea because we can't focus on more than one thing at once. If you're zoomed out so far, you can get a good big picture, but you can't discover the details. When you're zoomed in this far, you miss a whole lot of stuff. So I want to show you some of the things that you might be missing in this gigapixel picture. Next one there, Joel. Okay, here's some people. They're about four rows back. Clinton doesn't look too impressed, and George Bush, he's just clapping, I guess. So here's some former presidents. They're kind of hanging in the background. Next one. Okay, what's wrong with this picture? What's this camera guy doing? Okay, all the others are facing. Remember, it's the same picture. So Obama is somewhere over here. Where's that dude facing? I have no idea what he's zooming in on. Next. All right. Right behind Obama. I thought this was hilarious. Okay, look at this black gentleman, like two people back. He's either texting or sleeping, all right? Obama, look at this guy holding on to the railing here. He doesn't care. He's like, I get a prime seat. Anyone know who that is? I have no idea who that is. Supreme Court judge? Well, he doesn't care. He clearly does not care what's going on right now. He's thinking, I've got my hat, my earmuffs under that. I'm freezing. When do I eat? Okay, next. Okay, do you see what's wrong with this picture? What's wrong with it? This is way, way, way back in the crowd. Jordan sees it. Look at this girl down in the front there. She's tanning her face, okay? Next. Okay. I don't even know. He is in a yellow sleeping bag, and he is eating. Okay, he's consuming a gray USA Olympic toque. I have no idea what's going on in there. Okay, next one. This is my favorite. Those who are techie, you're going to get this. This is, if the camera is here and Obama's here, this is like right here. So it's really high res. And it says, it's a joke. Two stagehands walk into a bar. The second one has gaff tape. That's gaff tape. It marks off stage markings, where to step. Anyway, I just thought, if I was sitting behind that, I'd be very distracted. So you can see, look, if you're way zoomed out and you can see the overall plan, you're missing some of the detail. If you're way zoomed in, if you're sitting beside yellow sleeping bag hat-eating guy, could you pay attention at all? You'd be nudging your friends going, what is this guy doing? Or how about tan face lady, right? There's no way. When you are so zoomed in on your immediate surroundings, it's hard to catch a bigger picture. We as humans, we don't have the capability or ability to do that at all. We can either zoom out and kind of look at the big picture, and this is a great illustration for what we're doing with the story. We're missing some of the details somewhere, but we're zoomed way out for this next ministry season so we can see how it all stitches together. But in your life circumstances, and as we'll discover in Joseph's, we can only look at one thing at once. Now, go back to Joseph's story. You can skip the next slide there, Joel. And just in case, for those of you design people who are going to be really distracted trying to figure out what that is, that's a foot with a chain, all right, as a slave, all right? Now that we have that out of the way. Back to Joseph, all right? So Joseph goes to his brothers, says, I have these dreams. He's got this code. He's blessed. Things are going well. His brothers are out in a field way far away, and he's sent out to check on them. So he goes out, and while he's coming, his brothers say, hey, let's get rid of this kid. We don't like him anyway. Let's kill him. Now, the older brother, how many of you are the oldest sibling? Come on. Okay, so what you're looking at right now is the most reasonable people in the room, all right? I'm the oldest sibling. Reuben, the oldest sibling, says, no, we shouldn't kill him. Let's just toss him down a pit and he'll die on his own. Okay, now his real plan was to come back and rescue him, But then he wanders off. He wanders off, and the other brothers see this band of traveling salesmen taking all these goods from Canaan, where they were living, down to Egypt. And they think, okay, let's not kill him. Let's sell him. So they sell him to these people, and they take his coat. Joseph's gone, and Reuben comes back, and he's thinking, what have you done? What do we do? And they come up with another really smart plan, and they put blood all over this coat, and they take it home to Jacob. And throughout this message, I'll call him Jacob. I know his name's been changed to Israel, but as soon as I say Israel, you're going to think, is he talking nation or person? Jacob. They go home to Jacob, and they say, look what happened to your favorite son. He's dead. And Jacob is beside himself. In fact, the text says he's absolutely inconsolable. All right? Joseph goes down to Egypt, and he's sold as a slave. All right? He's put on auction. He's bought by someone fairly important in Egypt. He's not just the captain of the guard. This guy named Potiphar, he's the captain of Pharaoh's guard. Now, Pharaoh, if you don't know anything about Egyptian rule, he's in charge, right? He's the head guy. In fact, he is often seen as a god. Some pharaohs saw themselves more as a god than others. At very minimum, he is the intermediary between their gods, not God, their gods, and people. So it's the head of the guard to protect Pharaoh buys Joseph. Now, Joseph goes in as a lowly slave. He's doing his thing, and what starts to happen is that God's hand is with him. God's hand is on him, and everything that Joseph does succeeds. Everything. And Potiphar notices this, and he thinks, I should give this guy some more responsibility. And so he does, and everything that Joseph does succeeds. So then everything that Potiphar does succeeds, right? It says that all Potiphar had to worry about was when to eat. He just had to sit down and eat. How easy is that? So Potiphar's, you know, his whole household and all the things he's caring for, they're going swimmingly. Joseph's doing quite well. He's in charge of the household of the guy who's in charge of the guys who guard Pharaoh. And Potiphar's wife notices him. Maybe Potiphar's a bit of a jerk, or maybe Potiphar's not such a good manager or man at all. Maybe that's why Joseph can outperform him. And if we were maybe 50 years ago, we might say Joseph was a bit of a looker. Right? We would. Now we just, you know, girls just say he's hot. So Potiphar's wife thinks that Joseph is pretty hot. And so she goes to him, and she keeps bothering him and says, come to bed with me, sleep with me. And Joseph says, are you crazy? I've been put in charge of this whole household. How could I do such a thing to my master? He's still calling him master, right? And so then Joseph's coat gets him in trouble again. Okay, so first coat's bloodied, ripped off him. He's assumed dead. Second coat, he's got some coat he's wearing around the house to say that he's, you know, first in charge of the household. And he gets in some room with Potiphar's wife, and Potiphar's wife is very insistent. Come to bed with me. Come to bed. You've got to sleep with me. And Joseph says, no way. And he squirms himself out of the coat because she's so close, she's holding it. And he, like, ducks his arms out of these sleeves and takes off. And Potiphar's wife is furious. And she goes and finds Potiphar and says, guess what that servant of yours did? He came to me, and he asked me to sleep with him. In fact, he tried to force me. And when I screamed, he ran away, and I've got his coat right here. So Potiphar, he thinks to himself, I better, like, book an appointment and go down to Starbucks with this guy and hash things out. Because things, no way. Potiphar freaks right out. Without asking, without any other evidence. I mean, who would question their wife in that? No one. No one. Well, almost no one. He locks Joseph away in a prison. And there Joseph is. Joseph stuck in a prison. Okay? Favorite son, pit. In charge of a whole lot in a very important man's house? Prison. All right, and it says after a few years, Joseph starts the same thing all over again. God's hand is with him. He's given responsibility after responsibility, and eventually, he's put in charge of all that happens in the prison. I have no idea how a prisoner can have charge over his own imprisonment. But he does. He's given charge over all the matters that take place in this prison. And there's these two dudes who come from Pharaoh's house, okay? A cupbearer and a baker. They've made Pharaoh mad in some way, and he's cast them into this prison. And they start to have some troubling dreams. And they're talking to Joseph about it, and Joseph goes to God and says, can you help me interpret these dreams? And God does. And so Joseph correctly interprets these dreams, and eventually these two men are let out, and one is killed, and one goes back into service with Pharaoh. Remember, we don't know how much time has passed since he's gone to Egypt, sold, worked in Potiphar's house, and now is a prison. All we know is several years have passed. These guys get let out. The one guy's killed. The one guy's back in service with Pharaoh. 2 years later, somebody else has a dream. Pharaoh has a couple dreams, in fact. Very troubling dreams. And he has this dream where there's these seven fat cows who come up out of the Nile River, the main body of water in Egypt. And following them are these seven scrawny cows who come up and eat these seven cows. Now, in case you think that it's not a big deal, put yourself in Pharaoh's shoes. If you had that dream and vividly remembered it, you'd be troubled too. And he has a second dream where he sees a stalk of grain, and there's seven healthy, plump heads, and these seven scrawny heads rise up and swallow up the plump ones. And so he's pretty upset, and he's shaken by these, and he wants an interpretation. And he's the Pharaoh, right? You don't get it wrong. You don't tell the Pharaoh, here's what I think, Pharaoh. So no one's talking. But this cupbearer says, hey, I remember this guy back in prison who I pretty much promised to help get out and have forgotten about, but he interpreted a dream for me. Let's get him. And so Joseph is cleaned up. He's shaved. He's brought from a prison into the throne room of the highest authority in the land. And in fact, likely the highest authority in the known world. Egypt had a dynasty of over 3,000 years. They had 31 pharaohs who ruled over that period of time. They were powerful. And here's Joseph, cleaned up, shaven, probably in a new coat, standing before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh says, can you interpret this dream? And Joseph says, nope, I can't, but my God can. He has deep faith, and God does, and he correctly interprets the dreams. And he says, look, Pharaoh, my God has said, and if God has said it to me, then it's true. My God has said there are 7 years of plenty coming, and then there's 7 years of famine. And you better pick someone wise and intelligent who can figure this all out. And Pharaoh says, why not you? In fact, why don't you figure out how we can store up enough grain over these seven good years that we can make it through these seven bad years? In fact, I'm going to be continuing the most powerful person in this land, just in case you wonder, but apart from me, no one will be as powerful as you. You are second in command. They put a new coat on him. Pharaoh takes a ring off his finger, puts it on Joseph's finger. They take him all around the land, and people bow to him so that they know this is the guy. This is the guy who's going to help us make it through what's going to come. Now, I'm sure there are people who are doubting because there's 7 years of plenty. But it says they started to store up so much grain that Joseph stopped counting. You know, he'd take accounts because they need to portion that up. And God blessed the land so much, they stopped counting. So Joseph, favored son, pit, favored slave, prison, favored employee, favored temple person, grain measurer, guy. All right? Quite a roller coaster of a journey. Remember, Joseph had a family, right? And Joseph had a dream. Enter his family. Back in Canaan, the famine hits just like it was supposed to. A couple years after it strikes in Egypt, it's spreading. And so Jacob says to his sons, we're going to die. I hear Egypt has some grain. You go down and get some. And he sends 10 of them, but he says, Benjamin's my new favorite. I'm not letting him go. So these 10 sons go down, and they have to go before the governor of Egypt in order to barter and bargain for some grain. And so they go before the governor, and they bow their faces low to show that they're humble. Who's the governor of the land? It's Joseph. Now, as soon as they walk in, whatever room they're in, I'm sure it wasn't some little storehouse. It's probably something similar to a throne room. He's the governor of the land, and people are coming to him all day to buy grain because everyone's starving. He notices them right away, but they have no idea it's him. I don't know if he's done up in Egyptian garb, whatever it is, or if it's just they haven't seen him in so long and he was so young when he left. We don't know. They have no idea who it is. Now, Joseph has a choice here. Immediately, he remembers his dream, and he remembers, these guys who sold me into slavery, they're going to bow down to me, and they did. He's torn, isn't he? Because what does he do? He messes with them. He messes with them. He does. He could have just said, my brothers, I'm so overwhelmed. It's good to see you. I forgive you. Let's make everything right. Go get my blood brother and my father and all his wives and your... Come down here. We got it good here. You will be safe. Uh-uh. What's the first words out of his mouth? You're spies. You know, where have you come from? I don't trust you. You got to prove it. And so he asks them all these questions and finds out that they say they have a younger brother. And so he says, okay, if your story's true and you're not spies, then you've got to go back and get this brother. So he locks him in jail for 3 days. And then he says, I'm going to have mercy on you. And I'm going to keep one brother, Simeon, and I'm going to send the rest back and get this younger brother. And so the other nine go back and they tell Jacob, they say, look, this guy, he's a harsh man. He thinks we're spies. Simeon's in jail, and we need to bring Benjamin back. And Jacob says, no, you don't. I lost Joseph. Simeon's probably dead. I'm not losing Benjamin. But the famine gets bad. And Jacob says, there's nothing I can do. There's absolutely nothing I can do. So he says, fine, take Benjamin, go. You're going to bring this gray-headed man to his grave. Save that one up, guys. You can use that with your kids later in life when their kids aren't behaving. All right? You're going to send this gray-headed man down to the grave. The 10 go back, and now they're 11, and they're faced with Joseph. Now, Joseph, throughout this time, both when he sees his real brother Benjamin, when he's questioning the brothers, and when he sits them from oldest to youngest, they're freaked. How did this guy know to sit us from oldest to youngest? Joseph's messing with them, and he's really wrestling in his heart, isn't he? There are times, it says, where he has to duck out of the room and go weep because he's overwhelmed with emotion. And he cleans himself up and goes back. And after a while, he can't take it anymore. He can't play this game. Remember, he's not really making a decision. You know, he sent them back with some grain. He returns their money, so it kind of looks like they've stolen things. His younger brother's supposed to go back. He puts his personal silver cup in his bag, and they find it, and they're in trouble, and they're in fear for their life. He's messing with them. He could have just forgiven them, but he can't take it any longer. He can't take it any longer. And with tears, he reveals who he is. And he talks, Pharaoh hears about this. And Joseph and Pharaoh invite the whole family. In fact, they say, don't grab your things. Just go back, get your father, your wives. Don't bring anything. In fact, they took caravans and wagons, and they brought them back, and they set them up in the most lush land in all Egypt called Goshen. And that's where they saw out the rest of their days. Now, when I was studying this, I got kind of excited about what I thought the meaning behind all this was. You know, how does this tie to the overall story? We've got Eden, and we've got Abraham, and now we're focusing on Joseph. And I got excited. And I want to tell you what I think it was saying. This is what I thought initially. I was all fired up to preach it, and it was kind of exciting. And in my head, my inner Southern preacher, he started to rise up. Okay? And it sounded like something like this. If you are in the pit or the prison, God has not forsaken you. No, my dear friends. If you are into the pits or the prison, God has for you a palace. Sounds good, right? Amen? Amen. It sounds awesome. Sign me up for that life. Because Joseph, everywhere he's put, from the pit to the prison, he's given a top place. But here's what I began to realize. God does have a promise to take you from the pit or the prison to a palace. But your palace is not Joseph's palace. Okay? Joseph, his path, his story was to be deputy pharaoh. His story was to be first in command over Potiphar's house. His story. His story was that he would have riches. His story was that he would be in charge. He would have a name for himself. People would honor him. He would be in charge. He'd have position. That's his story. But when you look at the story of the Bible, Jesus had no place to lay his head. Jesus. Prophets? Nope. Some of them had some blessing and honor and served with kings, but many did not. Disciples? No. If you look at the Bible and the palace that many people are given, it's to be a prophet for some, to say to people things they don't want to hear. It's to be who God has called us to be. And so I started to ask God, what is the transcendent principle here? If you want to get us from the pit and the prison to the palace, what is it? There's got to be a key. There's got to be a catalyst. There's got to be something here, because we all have a promised palace. Okay, God doesn't keep you in the pit or the prison forever. It's a truth. How does he get us to the palace? And remember, for you, a palace might be being a joyful janitor, a quiet prayer warrior. For me, I remember a time early on in our ministry. We just had Alyssa. She was born premature. We had some tough times with our church over that. I was working, you know, more than half time on a pig farm to make up for our income. I was half-time in the church, but putting in like 30 hours, and I thought I felt called, and I didn't know what God was doing. I remember standing outside at like 5:30 in the morning, shoveling the stupid snow so I could get this little Pontiac Firefly thing up over the snowbank and drive through snowbanks at 5:30 in the morning to work in a pig farm, and I thought, is this it? This is suffering. I'm not getting along with my church. We didn't have a normal birth with Alyssa. All these things are going wrong. What are you doing, God? And I felt very much like I was in a pit or a prison. Yeah, that sounded funny. That came out wrong. You're normal. We love you. All right. For me, for part of my journey, my palace is just that, a journey. Your palace is just that, a journey. Joseph didn't arrive. He didn't arrive. We don't see much of the rest of his life, but we do know he lived out his days differently. Why? Why? Because it was with his family. Restored. Restored. For me, my palace is, I'm a pastor at this church for this time. I live at 153 Driftwood. I have these kids in this place, in this time, and I've been placed here, and it's good. There may be more pits or prisons to come. But here's the thing. God has a plan for you. Okay? Lessons we can learn. First of all, God has a plan. Secondly, okay, next. Next one there, Joel. God often chooses the least likely person or the most difficult way to accomplish his plan. We learned that last week. Okay, so God has a plan, but he chooses the least likely person, the most difficult way. Why? So we know who the author is. And so when we don't get caught up in this idea that God has promised all of us riches, position. No, that was Joseph's story. Third thing we can learn. You are not defined. Next one there, Joel. You are not defined by your current situation. Okay, you're not defined. If you are in the midst of a pit or prison, you're so zoomed in, right? Picture, you're so zoomed in, you can't have perspective. You're not defined by your current situation. Next lesson, you are defined by God's plan. You are defined by God's plan because he both is zoomed in and zoomed out at the same time. He sees how all the pieces fit together. He sees how all the pieces fit together. God cannot entrust you with your palace. Okay? God cannot entrust you with your palace. that place he's bringing you, not where it's full of blessing and abundance, but for a time, you can start to see your calling and live it out. God cannot entrust you with his palace until you've been through the pit or the prison. Okay? Ours is a journey. Next lesson. Okay? It's a journey. God cannot entrust you with the palace until you've been through the pit or the prison. Do you know why? Because in that suffering, Joseph learned the most important thing. What's the key? What's the catalyst? What's the difference? What is it that makes the difference between living in a pit or prison and dwelling in your palace or living out God's plan and call for you? What is it? Suffering. Suffering is the thing we all must, and I say must for a reason, walk through in order to get to the palace. And for Joseph and for us, the product of the suffering is more important than the suffering itself. If God intended for all of us just to dwell in a pit or all of us to be in a prison, there would be no hope in that. It's the product of the pit or the prison. And what did it produce? It produced forgiveness. Forgiveness. God's plan, his overall plan, is to put you into a pit or prison. You can say he caused it. You can say he allowed it. Same thing. He's letting you be there so that while you're there, you encounter suffering so you can learn to forgive. I wholeheartedly believe that if Joseph had have chosen bitterness, hatred, anger, rage while he was in that slave auction, while he was in that prison, Joseph's story would have went something like this. There was this guy, and he was a lowly slave at Potiphar's house, and he really didn't like cleaning up after camels. In fact, day after day, he complained about these lousy brothers. It was so unfair. He was condemned because he was born. It might have also sounded something like this. Joseph was put in prison, and he spent all of his days complaining that he's unjustly put there. It wasn't his fault. Just like a lot of other people there, but his story is real. And most of his stories would sound something like that Potiphar's wife, or my brother's this, or society that, or it's unfair, and I don't like this. When's God going to get me out of this place? Where is God anyway? I don't even think there is a God. Instead, Joseph allowed suffering to change him. God's plan all along was a palace, wasn't it? Without suffering, without the pit, without the prison, you don't have the opportunity to choose forgiveness. To choose forgiveness. And in the overall plan of God, if we zoom way out and look at his story, he's letting us know right early on, look, my world is about death and life. You have chosen death by disobeying me. I've had to throw you out of the garden, but I'm going to pursue you. And I'm picking a nation, a people, and I'm testing a man named Abraham. And Abraham's faithful, and it's through Abraham's family that I will bless all people. And I want you to know, next lesson, right away, my whole plan is about forgiveness. But forgiveness is about life. It's about death and life. But forgiveness is that catalyst. It's that key. It's the difference between entering into life or staying in death. It's the difference between staying in the pit and dwelling in the palace. And so God is showing us these things early on. And I just want to ask you two questions, then we're going to end with a song. Okay? Two questions. You can keep going there, Joel. I skipped some stuff. Keep going. There we go. Two questions. Number one, have you been forgiven? Number one, have you been forgiven? Forgiveness is the catalyst. It's the key. It's the thing offered you to enter into life with Jesus. God promises you abundant life. It was God's plan, his overarching plan. If we're zoomed way out, it's that we might have life and have it to the full. But because we've broken, because we've chosen to sin, because we walked away from God, God pursues us and says, even though you did this to me, I'm forgiving you. It's there for you to receive. Have you received forgiveness from God? Because if you haven't, you're going to keep living the kind of life you're living, and you're going to be experiencing death day after day. Not physical death, but you will never taste abundant life. Second, for those, this is more a question for those who follow Jesus, those who've made a decision to receive forgiveness and enter into life. Remember, Jesus' death on the cross isn't primarily about forgiveness. It's primarily about life and what God wanted for us when he created everything right at the beginning. For those of you who've chosen that, who do you need to forgive? Joseph followed God. Joseph loved God. But he would have been stuck had he become bitter. And some of us are stuck. We're stuck. And our lives are, we're miserable. We're looking at others and saying, why don't I have joy? We're looking at the stuff others have. We're maybe bitter because someone wronged us, and they did, and it hurts. Maybe it's our family. Maybe it's people around you. Maybe it's someone in this church. Maybe it's someone sitting close to you. And you are justified if we take the world's way in being angry and bitter and never talking to them. But if you do, you are making a choice to live a life of death. Now, you may be spiritually alive, but you will never taste the palace that God has for you. You will never walk in his fullness of his plan for you, ever. You never will, unless you learn this one key. You have received forgiveness for things more atrocious you've done towards God than anyone will ever do to you. That doesn't move many people. Okay, we can say that and you can feel differently than that. That is the truth. But unless you release bitterness, unless you offer forgiveness, it's not going to unlock your heart for God to change you. God wants to transform you. God wants you in the palace, right? He does. Absolutely. He wants that life for you. But he gives you free will, and he gives you a choice. Have you been forgiven? Who do you need to forgive? We're going to close just by listening to a song. Really pay attention to the words. This is a song specifically written for this chapter of the story. Give a listen.